This is Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org.
You say, I got to love my neighbor. Well, not really. Who would you say my neighbor is?
Who are my neighbors? Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. Today's show is, the first part is a bike ride that I took in Bell County, Kentucky, where I'm from, over the mountain through coal mining country. It's about an 8 or 10 minute clip. And then there's some stuff about Amazon boxes and trash and recycling. And then some clips from a compost conference that I went to in Jacksonville, Florida in January. We'll start with the bike ride over the mountain. I'm recording this on Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. I'm on the road that goes from Middlesboro, Kentucky, up Bondi Mountain. There's lots of coal operations this way. And I'm by the tipple for Bell County Coal. It rained last night and into the morning. And every stream and creek and dripping water I've seen is brown with mud and flowing rapidly. I don't think it rained that much, but it's just not much to hold it back. It's just gushing. You could go whitewater rafting on the smallest little stream. The noises you're hearing are the tipple. And it looks like an inloader pushing coal around. And now there's a line of 4 or 5 coal trucks that are entering the tipple. I think the tipple will load it onto the train cars. And the rail cars, I'm not sure where they go. To some power plant, I don't know where. The mountains rise up on both sides. But they're just scarred and sliced in half. That's a coal truck backing up. It's on a wall embankment, about 30 feet tall. It's starting to unload now and open up the tailgate and drop it all into the giant pile with the inloaders pushing it around. It's like a 30-foot tall pile of coal. There's about 10 signs in front of the entrance to the tipple. One says Bell County Coal Corporation, Middlesboro, Kentucky. Pignite surface mine. It's got the DNR number, the MSHA ID number, the state file number. Operator, Strata Mining. This is Canada Mountain Strip. Surface mine, this means strip mine. Mountaintop removal, whatever you want to call it. It also says Apollo Fuels, Middlesboro, Kentucky. Lots of permit numbers. Middlesboro Mining Operations Incorporated, Middlesboro, Kentucky. Attention, truck drivers are not permitted out of their trucks without proper hazard training. There's also a truck that looks like an oil truck or a water tanker that says dust control. It's kind of ironic. They need some mud erosion control when you look at the streams and creeks that are so brown you couldn't even see your finger if you put it in it. It says blast warning signal, another sign. First you got the warning signal, then you got the blast signal, then you got the all clear signal. The warning signal is a 1 minute series of long blasts from a siren, 5 minutes prior to the blast signal. The blast signal is a series of short blasts from a siren, 1 minute prior to the shot. All clear signal, a prolonged blast from a siren following the inspection of the blast area. Warning, explosives in use. Blast area marked by sign. Charged holes marked by orange cones. Well, if they think I look suspicious just standing around with my bicycle, who rides a bicycle around here? I've never seen anybody. Don't worry, I'm not going in. Actually, I will say, my mother has ridden a bicycle through here a few decades ago, and just knowing that she rode through here over the mountain gives me courage to know that, yeah, this is normal. I'm not some freak going to get automatically squashed like a bug from a coal truck. People do this.
Be careful.
Oh, the coals, they're all coming down, aren't they? They're going up and down?
Yeah.
Let me watch for you. All right.
Be careful.
Thank you. Right. That was a warning I appreciate. I thought they were all just coming down. So the thing I like about this scene, the muddy gushing water, the coal trucks, the mountains side carved off, the heavy equipment and the blast signs and all that, is that when you're home or wherever using electricity, this is it, folks. This is where it comes from. That's going to keep us warm tonight, and that's going to make our cell phones and our computers run. That's going to make our cars and bicycles able to be manufactured, and a lot more trash that we don't need. God, that mountain, that looks like the tallest mountain around. But the top of it looks like a moonscape. Where my dad's from in eastern Pennsylvania, coal mining country, even after 75 years since the land was stripped, the trees are hardly taller than like 15 or 20, maybe 25 feet tall. Still scraggly growing on slag heaps. It's hard for trees to grow when all the soil's washed down into the creek. You may think with all the natural resource extraction that it would stimulate the economy and jobs and stuff, but it doesn't seem like it. It seems like just a handful of jobs for the heavy equipment operators and the inspectors. Sure, I'm glad most of the trucks are coming down full and going up empty as compared to the other way around, going up full. So if they were going up full, I'd have a hard time breathing with all the diesel exhaust. And I sure need to be able to breathe to get up this mountain. Here I am, almost at the top. It took me an hour from Middlesboro, probably about 8 miles. I'm riding the same bike that my mama rode in 1986 and 1987 at the Ironman Triathlon in Hawaii. The same bike that she rode over this mountain many a time. This is a great bike. Schwinn Super Sport. I had it parked in front of Dollar General in Middlesboro, and a young woman came up to me and said, "Is that a Schwinn?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Wow, I've never seen a Schwinn bicycle before. But I have this pin that my granddaddy gave me that says Schwinn quality." And she showed it to me. It was pinned onto her book bag. And she was like, "But I've never actually seen a Schwinn bicycle. That's so cool." And I was just happy to have met someone that wanted to talk bikes. So at the top of the mountain is an old strip mine that was active when I was a kid, like 25 years ago. Now it says FCC Tower Registration Number, and there's a tower atop it, because there aren't that many tall trees to compete. Another great reason that it's good the full coal trucks are coming down and the empty ones are going up is because if the empty ones were going down, they would have been going a lot faster. But as it was, they're all going a nice slow speed. And all the drivers were very courteous to me, thanks to, I don't know what they were saying on their CB, but I appreciate it. On top of this bald, stripped mountain that was sort of so-called reclaimed probably 20, 25 years ago, it has kind of a beauty. There's grasses waist high on the knob. It kind of reminds me of a reclaimed landfill. Yeah, it probably looks like the Northampton landfill or the Hartford landfill or the Amherst landfill multiplied 100 times. I guess a lot of the things in the landfill may have come from here. The coal was dug and blasted off of the mountainside here and used to make many of the consumer items that we in turn throw away and put in landfills in western Massachusetts. So the mountains aren't really disappearing. They're just being transferred. Maybe another way to look at it is that they're being burned up, because the coal was burned, and then just, where did it go? It's like a wildfire that burns 100 feet deep. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. That piece was a little bike ride that I did in Bell County, Kentucky, where I'm from. This is a song by Lissy.
My darling, my dear, I tell you what is wrong. I went to the mountain, but the mountaintop was gone. Remember those trees where as kids we dreamed? They tore them down years ago and built a factory. And when that plant closed, the workers all left town. I read in the paper that some kids were killed when it burnt down. Now I stare at that field, black circle in the earth. And nothing will grow now, that's not soil, it's just dirt. And I can't stand it. What's the use in making something new if all that made us must be ruined? I can't demand it. I got nothing but mounting debt and fear. I scratch my head wondering how we got here. America, Americans, what are we doing? America, I am American, please can we start again? America, American, oh. Mountaintop removal, shame's our name. Darling, my dear, I tell you what is right. The moon on the lake and swimming by its side. But darling, my dear, I tell you what is wrong. I went to the mountain, but the mountain top was gone. And I can't stand it. What's what is wrong. I went to the mountain, but the mountaintop was gone. Mountaintop removal, shame's our name.
And that was a band called Lissy. Thanks for tuning in out there today. This is Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM. So my name is Ruthie Woodring. Since I've been doing this show for the last year and a half, sometimes I feel like I've never really introduced myself, only by happenstance. So let me take some time now to share a big part of my daily existence. Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I'm a trash hauler. Yeah, trash. What that means, being a trash hauler, is that like every day I'm sorting through stuff people have discarded, be it trash, recycling, compost, whatever. And I load it under a bike trailer and ride it to a transfer center where I drop it off. And later a truck comes to carry it on to another location. And I do that along with 14 comrades. So I think about trash a lot. It's my livelihood. Oh, but don't worry. I could do so many other things in life if there were no trash. So I wouldn't mind losing that kind of livelihood. Anyway, so I handle it a lot, and I think about where it came from, where it will go, why is it so heavy, and why is there so much, and why do people keep buying stuff, and how can this river of waste be slowed? Obviously, there's many factors that contribute to that, and there's a part of me that always thinks maybe if people just knew, maybe if they understood the effect that buying stuff has on other people and life on the planet, people would quit, or maybe it's an educational problem. Because like so many of the effects of our actions, we don't directly see the consequences. We don't see the forest cut down or the fracked earth or the oil spills or factories full of people trapped inside doing repetitive work. I mean, we kind of know these things exist, and they're related to our consumer choices and our economic system. But that information's it's kind of vague compared to the glitzy, in-your-face information about how the latest app on the latest computer phone is going to improve life. One thing I want to share that I've observed in my last 13 years as a trash hauler and 25 years as a dumpster diver is that everything that's bought will be thrown away, unless it's eaten or composted or maybe scrap metal. I see the toy boxes and appliance boxes come through paper recycling, and I know what to expect in the trash 6 months or a couple years down the road. So just keep that in mind when you buy something. Not only where did it come from and what went into creating it, but also where will it go next? And then what will become of it? Because its life is so much greater than the time it spends with us. So here's something else I want to share. It's an article that one of my coworkers sent from the New York Times from February 16th. Actually, I'll get to that article later. I got some other things to share first. It's about online shopping and Amazon boxes. So, like several years ago, I noticed some of my customers putting out cardboard boxes for recycling that had a label on them that said Amazon. And I thought Amazon was a bookseller, so I found it remarkable that some customers appeared to be buying a box of books a week, like sometimes more. And then other customers started putting out Amazon boxes for recycling, and I thought we'd hit a new age of literacy. But eventually, there was a point where I knew something else had to be up. And gradually, the online shopping epidemic started to register. Now, one of the things in the trash hauling business I'm part of, the 15 of us all have regular routes, and we give our routes nicknames like Tour de Tourd, or Trashectomy, or Debris of Progress, or Excessive Paperwork. Well, I recently noticed that one of my coworkers had nicknamed her route Amazon Prime. Here's Clarissa.
So I named my Pedal People route Amazon Prime because I realized as I was looking at what I was picking up that so much of it was this cardboard boxes with this very specific type of tape on it that says Amazon Prime all over it. And just made me think like, whoa, how'd that end up happening? and thinking about the people who pack those boxes and where that stuff comes from. I'm just picturing big warehouses with people running around finding random things to pack in boxes to be sent off. And And I just learned that Amazon's fastest delivery happened in 10 minutes. There's an order placed online, and it got delivered to somebody's door 10 minutes later. And I just, the abstractness of it all and kind of the absurdity of it is like kind of grotesque and fascinating at the same time. So I named my route after it. That's what the ducks think.
And here's something Alex has to say.
There's so much stuff that people could borrow that's right in their neighborhood that instead they buy their own of.
Well, why don't people borrow things more from neighbors?
Well, a lot of people don't know their neighbors, but I think even for those who do, there's you're adding a whole thing to the relationship to add more than just, you know, borrowing a little salt or something like that. And I think that if we need to create some structures to help assist in making sure those relationships are, that people are held accountable and that it feels like a fair system. I have ideas.
I'm sure you do.
But do I have the time to implement them? I'm working on it. But if anyone wants to help, contact me.
Like tool lending libraries and such?
Yeah. Been meaning to make a tool lending library for about 15 years. Shareit.org. Sharett.
Yeah, that's if you want to help Alex set up a tool lending library, probably in Florence, maybe in Northampton. So back to the article I was talking about. The title is E-commerce, Convenience Built on a Mountain of Cardboard, and it's from the February 16th edition of the New York Times. And, well, I'll just see if I can pull out some key quotes. Let's see. It says, the $350 billion e-commerce industry has doubled in the last 5 years, with Amazon setting the pace. Its Prime membership service has grown to more than 50 million subscribers by one estimate. And according to their website, its new faster service called Prime Now can get customers pretty much anything in minutes. That's a quote. What else? So, but it says the environmental costs can include the additional cardboard. Like 35.4 million tons of container board were produced in 2014 in the United States, with e-commerce companies among the fastest growing users, and the emissions from increasingly personalized freight services. Dan Sperling, he's the founding director of the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis, and a transportation expert on the California Air Resources Board. He says that there's a whole fleet of trucks circulating through neighborhoods nonstop. And as someone who travels around town for a living, I definitely have noticed that the UPS and the FedEx trucks, like, everywhere, all around, and the exhaust from that. Dr. Sperling says that consumers shared as much responsibility for the environmental costs of the deliveries as the companies that provided the speedy services. From a sustainability perspective, we're heading in the wrong direction, he said. Of course, it's hard to figure out all the effects, and there are possible trade-offs. As people shop more online, they might use their cars less, and delivery services have immense incentive to find the most efficient routes, keeping their fuel costs and emissions down. So far, though, according to the article, shoppers appear to be ordering online while still driving to brick-and-mortar stores, at least as much in the past, according to Dr. Sperling and other academics. One recent study explored the environmental effect of internet shopping in Newark, Delaware, and found that a rise in e-commerce in recent years by local residents corresponded to more trucks on the road and an increase in greenhouse emissions. Ardeshi Fagri, a professor of civil engineering at the University of Delaware, said the increase of various emissions, which he estimated at 20% from 2001 to 2011, could be due to a multitude of reasons, but we think that online shopping and more delivery trucks are really one of the primary reasons. Online shopping has not helped the environment, he said. It's made it worse. Someone else says that people both shop online and still drive to stores because People like to see and feel things, and they have to return things. I guess the other thing that this article made me think of and research a little bit more was with the low price of oil, the recycling industry is pretty hard hit because now it's cheaper to buy new materials than to recycle in many cases. So even stuff that you're trying to recycle, like, there's no market for it. Not everything, but many cases. But here's the best quote of the article. This is from Robert Reed, who's the spokesman for Recology, San Francisco's main recycling processor, which collects 100 tons of cardboard every day. He says, slow down consumption. Slow down. All right. And on that theme, here's another statistic I wanted to throw out here. This is from Yes Magazine. A little article entitled, How Far Can We Get Without Flying? By Peter Kalmus. He says, I have a friend who blogged on the importance of bringing reusable water bottles on flights in order to preempt the miniature disposable bottles of water the attendants hand out. Although she saved around 0.04 of a kilogram of CO2 by refusing the disposable bottle, her flight to Asia emitted more than 4,000 kilograms, equivalent to some 100,000 bottles. So, perspective.
Anthony, Mom said to take out the trash.
But it's freezing outside.
I know, but if we keep putting out lots of trash, it will warm up.
Huh? What are you talking about?
Global warming. Our trash gets burned and makes greenhouse gases. I kind of wish it went to the landfill instead. Methane is so much more effective than carbon dioxide.
But why do you want to make global warming worse?
I want to live on the beach.
But the beach is only a few blocks away.
Right, and if sea level comes up enough, we'll be beachfront. Melt those icebergs.
Hey, I put all those papers, bottles, and cans in the recycling bin. Why'd you put them into the rubbish?
I read on the South Shore Recycling Cooperative's website, ssrc.info, that it takes a lot more fuel to make paper, bottles, and cans from, virgin materials than from recycled stuff. Burn more fuel, more greenhouse gas. Before we know it, those obnoxious Sullivans across the street will be underwater, and I'll be having beach parties in the front yard.
You're nuts.
That was from Eastern Mass South Shore Recycling Cooperative.
When you get home at night and switch on the lights, do you feel good about the source of your electricity? Did you know that you can choose to power your home with 100% local, clean electricity? You have the power to say no to the standard mix of polluters like natural gas, coal, and oil. Make the switch to clean electricity produced right here in New England. It's easy. Sign up for New England Wind or New England Green Start without any contracts or commitments. Just go to www.massenergy.org/CET.
And here's a song from Macklemore and Ryan. They have a solution to online shopping.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up. This is awesome.
Now, walk into the club like, what up? I got a big. I'm just pumped, I bought some from a thrift shop. Ice on the fringe is so frosty, the people like,
that's a cold honky.
Rolling in hella deep, headed to the mezzanine. Dressed in all pink, set my gator shoes, those are green. Draped in a leopard mink, girl standing next to me. Probably should have washed this, smells like R. Kelly sheets. But it was 99 cents. I get copping it, washing it. About to go and get some compliments. Passing up on those moccasins. Someone else has been walking in bummy and grungy. Damn it, I am stunting and flossing and saving my money. And I'm hella happy that's a bargain. I'ma take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real. Ask your grandpa, can I have his hand me down? Your Lord jumpsuit and some house slippers. Dookie brown leather jacket that I found. Dig it. They had a broken keyboard. I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket. Then I bought a kneeboard.
Hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game. Hell no. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads will be like,
ah, he got the Velcro.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome.
Ow.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome.
What she know about rocking the wolf on your noggin? What she knowin' about wearing a fur fox skin? Whoa. I'm digging, I'm searching right through that luggage. One man's trash, that's another man's come up. Whoa. Thank your granddad for donating that plaid button up shirt. Cause right now I'm up in her stunt. I'm at the Goodwill, you can find me in the I'm not stuck on searching in the section. Your grandma, your auntie, your mama, your mammy. I'll take those flannel zebra jammies secondhand and rock that. The built-in onesie with the socks on them. I hit the party and they stop and that. They be like, oh, that Gucci, that's hella tight. I'm like, yo, that's $50 for a t-shirt. Limited edition, let's do some simple edition. $50 for a t-shirt, that's just some ignorant. All that, getting swindled and pimped. All that, getting tricked by business. That shirt's hella dope. And having the same one as six other people in this club is a hella don't. Peep gang, come take a look through my telescope. Trying to get girls from a brand, man, you hella won't. Then you hella won't.
Goodwill. Poppin' tags.
Yeah. I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome. I'll wear your granddad's clothes. I look incredible. I'm in this big coat from that thrift shop down the road. I look incredible.
Hey, come on, man.
I'm in this big coat from that thrift shop down the road. I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a comer. This is awesome.
Is that your grandma's coat?
Of course. This is Valley Free Radio, Northampton, WXOGOP. 103.3 FM.
All right, on Tuesday, March 8th, International Women's Day, we in Northampton will be celebrating the Code Pink, Western Mass Code Pink, will be honoring women resisting pipelines. Please join us for a fun evening of celebrating the struggle and getting lots of updates about what different organizations are doing around the Valley and throughout the Commonwealth. 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 8th, Lyman Hall, First Churches, downtown Northampton. Please join us and tell all your friends. Drumming, music, and some inspiration.
Thanks, Bucky. So we're going to get to some stuff about composting. Got a bunch of little interviews. We'll see how far we get. But this first one, first 5 minutes, this is Susan Waite from the solid waste coordinator or the recycling coordinator for the city of Northampton.
So, Susan, can you tell me, like, why should people make the extra effort to compost? Why not just, isn't it easier to just throw everything in their kitchen garbage bag, your trash bag?
It is a lot easier. The reason why it makes so much sense to compost is because organics is a pretty large percentage of our municipal waste.
And it's heavy. I can say as a hauler, it's heavy.
It is very heavy. And
it takes a lot of energy to move that stuff.
Absolutely.
Far.
So it's wet, it's heavy, and it's a resource that can, or at least it can be turned into something very useful. So it's when you ship it, it has to get shipped to either, say, a place in like Seneca Falls, New York, or to a incineration facility nearby. And the problem with organics is that it's wet. And so when you put something wet on a fire, what happens? It cools the fire down. So they prefer not to have organics in an incineration facility, or at least wet organics like kitchen scraps. You know, wood waste is one thing. So the fact that it's wet is not good. The fact that it's heavy is not good, because then we're using more gas or resources to haul it places. And it's something that's really useful. You can very easily, with few bells and whistles, turn it into a soil amendment that makes everybody happy.
Do you know where the compost that goes to Locust Street Transfer Center is going right now?
No, I don't. I think it's going somewhere in Hadley.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what ARS told me last
time. Yep, somewhere in Hadley. And the other thing I wanted to say is the Environmental Protection Agency estimates that about 13% of municipal solid waste is kitchen scraps and 13% is yard trimmings. But the state of Massachusetts does a what they call a waste characterization study with information from incineration facilities around the state. Mm-hmm. And the average, they most recently conducted one in 2014. And so the average for the state of Massachusetts of percentage of material going to the incineration facility that is organic is 27%. So that's the state average. And our local incineration facility measured during the study 31% from they're in Agawam, I think, or mm-hmm. at least in Springfield area. So that's all of the incineration stuff that was sampled, 31%. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah. And wet stuff makes the temperature go down, temperature of a fire go down. Mm-hmm. And so does it also like increase the smoke and the pollutants when the temperature drops, do you know?
I don't know. It seems logical that yeah. might happen, but I really don't know. The other issue with it being wet is if it's transported to a landfill facility, being wet inside a sanitary landfill is not perfect either because they drain all of the liquids off of that. And it just becomes this effluent that sometimes can be a little yucky, shall we say. So if you're putting food waste that has moisture in it, it's just adding more work, not to mention there's no reason for it to be there in the first place.
It's like taking a natural resource and turning it into a toxin.
Yeah. Yep, yep, absolutely, because you don't know what it's going to get mixed in with in the landfill.
Someone told me once, well, if I put all my kitchen scraps in the trash and it goes to the landfill, someday, it'll just help everything in the landfill break down.
Well, so that's probably, that's something that people don't really understand about landfills, is that it's sanitary landfill. They are constantly draining collected liquids from the bottom. So there's this really thick rubber layer, you know, I don't know if it's a rubber, you know, this really super thick layer that they lay down on the bottom. They put the trash, it gets compacted, and then they put another thick layer on top. So your waste is really entombed in a landfill, and they constantly are pumping out water from the bottom to prevent methane formation. So once, you know, I think the first 20 years of a landfill is when when the liquids are forming at the pooling at the bottom, and that's also when methane generation is greatest during the first 20 years of a landfill. And we know that methane is a really bad greenhouse gas. So it just doesn't make sense to put it in either place. You just, you know what, buy a backyard composter, a composter, but don't even buy one. Just put some cinder blocks together and mix it with your leaves from the fall, and everybody will be happy.
Right. Or bring it to the transfer center or contract out with the local hauler to pick it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Great, thanks.
You're welcome.
So that was an interview with Susan Waite of Northampton. The next couple of interviews are from the composting conference that I went to in January.
I'm Brenda Sanders, and I am a zero waste community organizer with Energy Justice Network, which is an environmental justice organization that fights off polluting industries in minority communities.
One of the issues that you brought up at the panel yesterday was about how this incinerator is being put in a community of color in, Baltimore? Yeah, can you talk about the connections a little bit between like composting and this, or just talk about your work if that's kind of too vague.
Sure. So My professional work is environmental justice work, and that's where I work to fight off incinerators and landfills and medical waste burning facilities. But then my labor of love is food justice work. And so I help build community gardens. I help to teach folks how to take back control of their food systems in areas where marginalized folks are not in control of the food. And so composting really plays into that work, into the garden work, because it's just one more component that gives folks more control over the whole process from beginning to waste, you know, from growing the food to eating the food and then to disposing of the food in a way that kind of feeds back into itself. The environmental justice work that I do definitely intersects with the food justice work all the time. Not really sure how to incorporate that into the composting, but I've been discovering new things all the time about the different connections that are there. For instance, we try to teach folks in these marginalized communities about the importance of eating healthy foods, of eating lots of fruits and vegetables. And then I found out that a lot of the toxins that are emitted from waste burning actually bioaccumulates in animal products. And so because of these trash burning facilities, a lot of the animal products, you know, meat, dairy, eggs, are full of toxins like dioxin, which is a really, really toxic chemical. And so it kind of, you know, the burning of the trash feeds into the contamination of the food system. So just those little connections there are really important to doing all of this work.
Can you mention some other names that are used for incinerators?
Oh, yeah. So waste to energy facility is one of the ways that they've rebranded themselves because there is a tiny amount of energy that can be captured through the steam. And so they allege that they're selling off this captured energy. But the payoff is not equal to the amount of harm that's being done to the communities where these incinerators are located. Another one is power plant. Same deal. So there are a lot of regulations that they don't have to follow when they're labeled a power plant that they would have to follow if they were branded an incinerator. For instance, incinerators are not able to operate any less than a mile away from a school, whereas power plants can. And so a lot of them incinerators have been able to get into areas and just really be a detriment to the health of the children in that community because they've rebranded themselves as power plants.
That's a serious loophole.
Yeah.
I wonder if you also could say anything about in your work with community gardens and growing healthy food and stuff. Do you find it a challenge working with African-American communities, like with the legacy of slavery and sharecropping and all that? Like, do you find that because of that history, people might have a little bit of an aversion to having to work the land?
That's interesting. I've never actually heard that happen, and it's never, ever happened to me. One of the legacies that we do have to deal with a lot is the legacy of slave food. And so a lot of the throwaway food that was given to enslaved peoples are still very prominent in Black people's diets today. And so things like, you know, pig entrails and you know, gizzards and, like, body parts that I'm not even sure what they are still, and they're terribly unhealthy. And but it's become like a tradition. It's like, you know, folks during that time took a necessity and made the best of it. Yeah. And so that tradition has kind of, you know, it's rolled over into the present. And so it's sometimes really difficult to get folks to be open to eating, you know, some asparagus or, you know, some whatever, because they're used to the pig's feet, the, you know, the hooves, the snouts and things like that. And so sometimes breaking tradition is really traumatic
for people. And so I have had to deal with that.
Yeah, that's like part of how you, you know, define yourself and protect yourself and your who you are in this hostile world. Yeah.
Right. I would be really interested to know, have you heard of folks who...
Yeah, well, yeah, I've heard that that's a big challenge with, particularly like, you know, you get the do-gooder white people that want to go in and help people with all these community gardens in minority communities. But I think sometimes, like, the young white people just don't really take into account or don't really realize, like, the impact of people being like, no, I left the South because that was just, that history is just too traumatic, and I don't want to be, you know, digging in the dirt, getting the vegetables out of the dirt.
That's interesting, and I wonder if it's specific to white folks coming in, because when I go into these communities, they're like, oh yeah, my grandma taught me how to do this, so we used to grow, we had a garden down south, and so that kind of thing. So maybe it kind of goes back to the fact that the folks who should be doing this work should be the people from those communities. And I know that there's a lot of controversy around that, and there's a lot of people who want to do good, and they want to do good in the places where it's needed the most. But I will say that I've always gotten a really good reception because I am from there. I understand. I know what to say. I know what not to say. Mm-hmm. I know how to reach out. I know, you know. So I think that if folks want to do this work, you know, if white folks want to do this work, they should definitely connect first with people within the community and kind of follow their lead, because a lot of times there is somebody in that community who either is doing the work or has thought about doing the work or wants to do the work. And I think that the legwork should be done to find out who those people are, connect with them, and kind of have a partnership as opposed to coming in and saving people.
Right.
So
is there anything else you'd like to ask?
No, just thank you. This is like my third interview. It's really interesting that people think that they care about what I have to say.
Yeah, definitely. And I think your work is so important.
Thank you.
Hey, that was an interview with Brenda Sanders from a composting conference that I went to. Brenda Sanders of Zero Waste Network in Baltimore. I think we have time for one more interview from the composting conference. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to WXOJLP 103.3 FM Northampton, Valley Free Radio, and the show is Out There. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock.
Hey, my name's Debbie Ullman. I'm from New York City, and I have a project called New York Compost Box Project, where we encourage people to think outside the box while depositing their food scraps inside of one. So it's a sort of guerrilla project where go around the city and take unused newspaper boxes and turn them into guerrilla compost drop-off sites that are accessible to commuters 24 hours a day. And my background is I worked at a newspaper for 24 years. So part of it is sort of a nod to the decaying newspaper industry as well.
Mm-hmm. So how does this really work? Okay, so you see the boxes around town. You see they're abandoned. And then what do you do?
They're hard to spot, too, because they look exactly like real working. They have real newspapers, but fake headlines and everything, all having to do with composting. So once people understand what they're for, they all live at sites where they compost on site, where the stuff is composted on site. So then none of the organics go more than 10 feet away from where the box is. One of them is a bokashi box, and the other two are regular composting boxes. Yeah, right now I only have three because I just don't have any more boxes. I'm trying to do this legally and not steal the boxes. So, yeah, they've been pretty great. No contamination as of yet, and except stickers, and getting a few hundred pounds every 2 weeks from one of the boxes, and the project is very new, so it's only been like, I put them out in the middle of November, and I haven't been sued yet by News Corp, and the city hasn't gotten rid of them, and they're out on the street, so.
And so what is the labeling like?
So it looks exactly like the New York Post, but I added those special three extra COM letters before the Post, so it looks exactly like the New York Post branding, but says New York Compost. It's and, really a visual thing, not a radio thing.
And then how do people put their scraps in the box?
Oh, so one of the boxes is actually locked because it's the bokashi box. So They need to understand how it works before they can put their scraps in, but there are 2 5-gallon plastic buckets inside, so it's not like you're throwing your stuff in, although the buckets fill up quickly and then people just throw their, but most people use bio bags or something of the like and throw their stuff in.
So. And then when you empty it, you said you just take it like 10 feet away to like, or so, very close.
Yeah, so really we're taking it.
You back,
we're
you have to get this close really, to your mouth.
Really, we're taking it right, like a few feet away. Unfortunately, one of my sites, the one that's doing the best right now, they just have tumblers and they're all full. Uh-huh. So I go once a week and bring it elsewhere. Wait, what's the newspaper up there?
The Daily Hampshire Gazette?
No, that doesn't work with post. Compost.
That's pretty clever.
I'd like to go national and do the U.S. Post Office and make it compost office boxes, but I think that, I'd get in a little bit more trouble for that.
So I'm with Michael Robinson of Rust Belt Writers out of Cleveland, Ohio, at the Compost Conference in Jacksonville.
Well, Rust Belt Writers is a worker-owned, cooperative. We're a food waste solution servicing Northeast Ohio.
How did you get started? What do you do?
Cleveland, Ohio is home to a robust network of community gardens. We had a garden that was in desperate need of soil amendments, and we ventured that other community gardens had the same problem, and sure enough, they did. So we started to compost at our own community garden. Started hauling food scraps from restaurants and cafes and juice bars to our garden, and then realized that other gardens would be willing to partner with us. So using bicycle and bicycle trailer, we started hauling the food scraps from the restaurants and cafes and juice bars to up to 9 community gardens in Cleveland.
When did you start doing this?
This was in June 2014 was the first pickup that we did.
Okay, so it's been like a year and a half.
Yeah, and busy year and a half.
Yeah, how's it going?
Everything's going really well. We haven't used the bicycles in quite a while. We got away from that last winter after we had an accident and then saw increasing demand for our services. Unfortunately, the sprawling nature of the people that wanted to work with us, we weren't able to service them on bicycle. Mm-hmm. So we moved towards a cargo van. So now we work with a cargo van, and we're negotiating with a larger chain of grocery stores, in which case we would need to get at least one 20-foot box truck.
How has your experience of doing it changed going from biking to driving?
It was really difficult. It was definitely a point of tension for us in the cooperative because we wanted to make sure that that was a decision that was made on consensus. And it was that classic situation of we wanted to do it like that, but in order to make the financial model work, we wouldn't have been able to do it on bicycles. We wouldn't be moving any food scraps today if we would have continued to try to do it on bikes. So we had to move towards the cargo van and retool the pricing structure a little bit. So it was a very difficult decision, and we are still currently, one of the nice things about the conference is I've been able to talk to some of the other bike haulers, and a conversation started to roll about how a box truck or a cargo van might be able to work in tandem with a bicycle pickup service, or maybe what are the other benefits that a bicycle pickup service brings to the composting industry in general. I think one of the things that Dustin said from Compost Peddlers was, he phrased it like something like there's no windshield. And I think that that goes a really long way in building community and engaging people on the street, because when you're biking around with a trailer full of 18-gallon totes, it's not something that people see every day, and they end up asking you questions about what you're doing, and then really great conversations start around diverting food waste from landfills and facilitating urban agriculture at community gardens, and that wouldn't have happened if we would be in a cargo van or a box truck.
That was an interview with Michael Robinson of Rust Belt Writers Compost Haulers in Cleveland, Ohio. The last 3 interviews were from people at a composting conference that I went to represent Pedal People in Jacksonville, Florida back in January. And that does it for today's show. Thanks for listening to Out There. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. This is Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton. And streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Black History Month by honoring the voices of a revolution. From the Montgomery bus boycott to the Black Power movement to the fight for reparations, Pacifica was there.
It's the fire of my eyes, the flash of my teeth, the ride of my breast, the jaw in my feet, 'cause I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me.
Poet Maya Angelou performing Phenomenal Woman for Pacifica Radio in 1978. The airwaves of Pacifica radio stations included some of the most important African-American thinkers, artists, poets, writers, speakers, and activists of the 20th century. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
And I should say, if you want to hear archived editions of Out There, they're online at weatherbeard.com/out there.